As most of you know, last week I began an ongoing reflection series on what could be summed up as the soul and society that I'm calling Soul Focus. As I proceed, I will recap some key points, though I can only do so much of that. So if you miss any or want to listen again, remember that like every UUCPA talk, you can find audio recordings on the website. But since last week was the first week, I'll offer a bit longer review today, including a few overall points. The first of those is that it will take some time to show how ideas about the soul affect our cultural conditions. But like an ongoing TV series, gradually things will come together. So while questions may arise, most of them will be answered as we go. That said, these reflections don't presume to resolve every complexity or ambiguity or difficulty concerning human suffering, inequity, or iniquity. Nonetheless, as you began to hear last week, from the start, they take up aspects of these in uncommon ways, and to my mind, offer some potent remedies to widespread individual and collective ailments. Yet particularly toward the start, aspects of what I propose may sound foreign to some contemporary ears. Hence, I ask you again to listen with what Buddhism calls beginner's mind, an attitude of receptiveness toward the unfamiliar mixed with a bit of patience. And to summarize a couple things on the presentation I mentioned last week, while I cite the authors I draw from, I seldom note specific sources. Also, at times, I've abridged their words, but normally won't specify those either. Also, while I'll sometimes say quote, I'll mostly indicate quotations through verbal inflections. And I've adjusted some quoted works to reflect gender-inclusive language. Now to recap last Sunday. In future, I won't say nearly this much, but again, since we're just starting, this is a little more extensive. I talked about the inner unease and confusion many friends and I experienced as young teenagers, then extrapolated that to a much more widespread malaise among both youth and adults. This is shown most graphically by a 2024 CDC study that said more than 1 in 5 high school students considered killing themselves during the year before they were surveyed. More than 1 in 5. And while acknowledging that numerous factors, personal, familial, social, economic, environmental, contribute to states of mental and emotional health, and that their disparate effects negatively impact some people far, far more than others, I suggested a bigger picture underpinning, that while the modern era has given humankind a profusion of gifts, its claim that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational, aspect from human life, and thus created what world religion scholar Houston Smith terms an abnormal condition for the human spirit. I then explained why time-worn religious traditions can no longer remedy this, summed up by mythologist Joseph Campbell saying that our totally transformed modern context has now, quote, rendered the ancient formulae ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious. And I cited some statistics to show how many people have indeed wisely jumped ship. Yet offered only modernism's abnormal condition alternative, countless people suffer, even unto despair. And I left off by saying that thankfully a different transrational template fit for our present circumstances is freely available, including to you UUs, and the 2/3 of America's religiously unaffiliated, now this is the religiously unaffiliated, who yet hold that, quote, humans have a soul or spirit, and that there is something spiritual beyond the natural world, even if we can't see it. So, moving forward from that, and again inviting you to adopt a beginner's mind posture, I'll repeat the 2 pertinent quotes I shared last week. The first is from Shakespeare's Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in our philosophy. And the second from American cartoonist, writer, humorist, journalist, and playwright James Thurber. All people should strive to learn before they die what they are running from and to and why. For clarity, I'll lay out this transrational so-focused template's four main points and briefly share its main source. I'll then offer a few key upshots that just begin to demonstrate its validity and value, which the rest of this series will unfold. Point one, human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling slash destiny. Point two, the most beneficial thing a person can do for oneself and others is to identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible. Point three, people can do this fully with no reference to or reliance on God or any ultimate deity or reality. And point four, this orientation holds the power to heal, inspire, and save lives, and thus help create a better society. While many spiritual and philosophical traditions attest to the soul's existence, the principal model here comes from the Greeks, specifically Plato. Though called the myth of Er, spelled E-R, myth here means account rather than legend. That said, since modern folk often tend to hear things literally, it's important to separate this condensed summary's allegorical imagery from the underlying transcendent truth it describes. In concluding his best-known work, The Republic, Plato recounts what can be loosely called the near-death experience of a wounded soldier named Er. In that liminal state, Er observed how each soul prepares for its next earthly incarnation by meeting with the three fates, collectively depicted as the goddesses Moirai, plural of the Greek Moira, meaning a portion or allotment. They bestow both the outer conditions, fate, and inner blueprint, destiny, of its upcoming mortal experience, that is, the soul's lot in life. I'll insert that fate is not fatalism and destiny is not predestination. A blueprint is not the building and much free choice remains. More to come. Continuing toward incarnation, the soul is then united with a spirit companion that accompanies and guides it on its corporeal excursion. The Greek name for this was daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, and in the Roman Empire's Latin, genius. Finally, just before a soul incarnates, it drinks from the river of forgetfulness known as Lethe, L-E-T-H-E, and therefore forgets its blueprint. But the daimon remembers and safeguards the arrangements they and their new human embodiment all share. This keeps the personified soul in touch with its transcendent source and imbues the person with an individual calling and destiny. No doubt, this chronicle sounds fanciful to many contemporary ears. Raised on the premise that the materialist account of the world tells the whole tale. But history is littered with immutable certainties now outgrown. And I propose that the unambiguous affirmation of an animating connection to a transcendent more at your core that holds the seeds of a distinctive destiny is the only root remedy for modernism's abnormal condition of soul-starving spiritual barrenness. As archetypal psychologist James Hillman avows, for that is what is lost in so many lives and what must be recovered, a sense of personal calling that there is a reason I am alive. A periodic colleague of Hillman's, the brilliant mythologist Michael Mead, similarly reports that most of the cynicism, violence, apathy, and depression that young people, and, I'll add, myriad others, suffer can be attributed to not being recognized and welcomed as the unique individuals they already are inside. And he explains that unlike the current common meaning of genius as exceptional ability, genius and its older form, genie, J-E-N-I-I, refer to the spirit that is already there, the awareness of which provides an instinctive orientation, an inherent sense of direction and purpose in one's life. Direction and purpose are the antithesis of depression and suicidal despair, as well as an antidote for other symptoms alluded to soon and discussed more later. Hence, it's no stretch to say that what I'm calling this soul focus orientation can save lives. When Plato declares that it may preserve us if we are persuaded by it, we can take him at his word. Witness a young black kid in Depression era Chicago. Food often being scant, his grandmother snares and serves up rats. At age 7, he sees his mentally ill mom strapped into a straitjacket and institutionalized. His stepmother regularly beats him. His often absent father is a master carpenter, but also connected to a street gang. Through that affiliation, the grown boy later said, all I saw were dead bodies, Tommy guns, and stogies, and piles of money in back rooms. And despite once having had a hand pinned to a fence by a switchblade, quote, when you're a kid, you want to be what you see, and I wanted to be a gangster. At the onset of World War II, he moves when his dad takes work at a naval base in Washington State. When he and some friends break into a recreation center to pilfer snacks and drinks, he decides to also force open the staff office. One contains a small piano, but nothing of value. Or so he thought. Because when he stepped out and shut the door, quote, something said to me, idiot, go back in that room. I went back in the room and touched the piano, and every drop of blood in my body said, this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And it saved my life. He joined his high school or junior high choir and the band, where he learned piano, drums, and several brass instruments. Soon considered a musical prodigy, he rapidly made a name for himself playing trumpet in local clubs. That name was Quincy Jones, who besides creating his own music, came to produce and arrange for dozens of world-renowned performers, including Aretha Franklin and Frank Sinatra. He also guided Michael Jackson from child star to global phenomenon in producing Jackson's breakout album, Off the Wall, and later Thriller, the best-selling pop record in history. Along with building a lucrative media empire, Jones won 28 Grammy Awards, third all time, was nominated for 7 film score Oscars, and garnered a Kennedy Center honor for lifetime artistic achievement. Quincy Jones said it himself, I touched the piano and it saved my life. And about how responding to one's calling also benefits society, receiving the Motion Picture Academy's Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award is obviously several worlds away from the cultural output of a wannabe gangster. Though Jones didn't consciously possess a soul-focused framework, his calling surfaced so forcefully it was somatic. Every drop of blood in my body said. But for many people, perhaps most, it appears more subtly and gradually. In such cases, this lens helps us spot what might otherwise pass unnoticed and trust the destiny-driven stirrings in our own blood and bones, even when less intense or obvious. Since other upcoming destiny moment examples also tend to show the diamond's call plainly, I'll stress that this is only to illustrate in sharpest relief what operates in us all. And while some of those profiled achieved remarkable things, Hillman underscores that extraordinary people are not a different category. The workings of this engine in them are simply more transparent. A genius belongs to everyone, including you. And the capacity to read our lives and those of others, not least our children and youth, in this way is a serious, sometimes life or death, matter. With this framework now in mind, your supple beginner's mind, listen again to our reading words. I'll preface them by saying that while the voices Mary Oliver mentions often include those of individuals, for me, they also comprise both those of outmoded traditional religions, by which I mean mainly believe this or go to hell, Christianity and Islam, and of modernism's soulless void. Here is the journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. More next Sunday. Namaste. And blessed be.